Hi, I'm Kyra Kellawan, an international educator with experience of careers and college counselling in schools and universities across four countries. You're listening to the Piloted Podcast, a show about innovation in education for teachers, parents, and students. Hello, and welcome back to episode 10 of Piloted. Series 1 is drawing to a close, but this week's guest was something of a surprise appearance. She's an educational heroine of mine. Rebecca Ziegler-Mano is the founder of Ed Matters Africa, the USAP community school, and also one of the founders of the HALI Access Network. HALI stands for High Achieving Low Income, and its 20-plus organizations work in more than 30 countries across Africa, supporting thousands of students on their journeys to find post-secondary options with funding. Rebecca's own teaching career spans over two decades and has seen her in classrooms from coastal Kenya, Northern California, and now in Zimbabwe. She has devoted her professional life to college equity and access for talented low-income students. In 2000, she founded the United States Achievers Program, or USAP, and she worked for a long spell as the country coordinator for Education USA in Zimbabwe. The program's goal is to encourage and assist talented but economically disadvantaged high school graduates to access scholarships and full funding at top US universities. Starting off with just 13 students, USAP has grown into an international program spanning continents. Rebecca's vision of educating the underprivileged has broken through borders and created its own dedicated network of educational advisors in countries as far-reaching as Mongolia, Brazil, Ecuador, and the UK. Rebecca is active as a presenter, trainer, and leader in international educational organizations, including NAFSA, IACAC, and the Council of International Schools, where I saw a moving keynote from her on USAP's work last November. That speech led me to reach out directly to Rebecca. I was, as you can imagine, delighted to discover that she listens to Piloted on her morning walks and that she could make time to be a guest. Well, I want to formally welcome you to the Piloted Podcast, Rebecca. As you know, I'm a huge fan of what you do, and I'm just so excited that you are able to speak to us today.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
So I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about your professional journey to get to this wonderful thing that you do at the moment.
Sure. I guess it's hard to know how far back to go, but in summary.
In terms of teaching, I suppose. We could start
there. Yeah, in teaching. I studied anthropology and African studies at Brown University as an undergrad. And I spent my junior year in Kenya and studied the cultural context of education in Kenya. And that was wonderful and fascinating, sort of first take on the continent, and obviously pre-cell phone, pre-internet, where I just wrote aerograms home and hoped my parents got them a month later. But really had a great experience. And then after I graduated and after a few years of working in the US, I really wanted to get more of a sense of education on the ground here. And so I had met a visiting grassroots development leader in the US from Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. And he said that he and his wife would welcome me to their school, but they did not have an English teacher. And I felt like that was the one skill that I did have. So I came to Zimbabwe for a year and a half until my money ran out. I just had a letter from him with directions, and I went to a rural school about 5 hours from the capital and taught English there. And it was very eye-opening about how mismatched the education was to the kids. You know, an education that had reading comprehension passages about snow and sledding that kids are answering questions on for their English O-level exam. So that led me to grad school. In grad school, I was, again, looking at assessment internationally and the disconnect between assessment and culture. I was at Stanford. And then I started teaching. And I started teaching in East Palo Alto, which was an inner city situation. In mm-hmm. California, my first class was formerly incarcerated young men, and I was teaching Othello. It was very interesting, and I just really loved connecting with kids. And it was sort of at that point where I realized that there was this target population that, of course, every kid is in need of a great education, but the target population that I really honed in on that I wanted to work with were very determined, high-achieving kids who came from disadvantaged backgrounds and so did not have any opportunities. And it came to be what is now very commonly known as college access. When I fast-forward, my husband, I met at Stanford, and when we decided to move to Zimbabwe, which we thought would be for 1 or 2 years, it's now been over 20, I realized that college access programs were taking off in the United States, which was fantastic. But as my journey here found, there was really, at that point, no college access program internationally. Mm-hmm. So my first job was in Zimbabwe was at the U.S. Embassy as the educational advisor, where I stayed for quite a while. And within a year, I asked my boss, who later became an ambassador and who is now the head of our board, Bruce Wharton, incredibly inspirational mentor. And I just asked him, I said, I want to do something proactive. We just wait for students to walk into the embassy and say they want to study in the U.S. and we work with them and they are the elite. They are the people who feel they can and they deserve to go internationally for university. But there are brilliant kids out there. And what about if we went and found those kids and told them there are opportunities for them to get scholarships and then help them do it? So that's how USAP was born. We are celebrating our 20th year. We call it USAP at 20 this mm-hmm. year. Fast forward, there are 450 about USAP students around the world who got to study in the U.S. through this program that I started at that time. So I spent quite a long time at the embassy, and I realized with more and more time that what I wanted to do would take more than just meeting kids during their school holidays, which was the USAP model, and that I really wanted to focus on what does a transformative education look like for a high-achieving, low-income student. And why is that different than any student? Because maybe they haven't had a stronger educational background, because maybe they have all the first-gen characteristics of any first-gen student of not having exposure to what opportunities really are out there for them. And because the embassy situation, obviously by mandate, does not care what happens to the student after they get on the plane. Mm-hmm. And I was very much wanting to, and was, staying in touch with my students, realizing they need a supportive structure when they're in college and afterwards to think about what legacy they want to leave. If they want to come home, how do they come home? Yeah, I think it's very unfair that we tell students all the time, like, you must go back. We don't want brain drain. Go back to your country. But we do nothing to show them how to do that and how they would get a job, how they would forge a career back at home. Just to finish this career, this long story, in 2015, end of 2015, I decided to leave the embassy, took a huge, huge pay cut, and start a nonprofit. And I started Education Matters. We opened our doors. I think if there's one career advice I will lend is never to launch a nonprofit without taking a break first. I finished work Friday and opened the doors on Monday and did not take a break. I still am missing that break.
It's 2015.
And that was 2016, January. started Education Matters and with a tagline, where talent meets opportunity. Mm-hmm. And the point was to have USAP as the flagship program, but really to be open to having different programs that would help talented students find opportunities. So we ran a student-athlete cohort for student-athletes looking for scholarships. We're the local partner for the Yale Young African Scholars and now the local partner for the RISE program out of the Rhodes Trust. We run an internship program called Zimbabwe Career Connect, where Zimbabwean students can come home during their college years and do internships at home mm-hmm. and get professional experience at home to see what it would look like to work at home. So we have a variety of programs, but the main focus is USAP, which is still the idea of selecting really bright and determined kids from very disadvantaged backgrounds around Zimbabwe and bringing them together to help them launch them to tertiary education. And then after starting Education Matters, it became more and more clear to me that this passion that I've always had of starting a school and really changing the school culture for what a model school for high achieving, low income students would look like, that passion was just not leaving me. So we opened our doors to the USAP Community School this January with our first class of 45 lower six A-level students, which 11th graders for those mm-hmm. in the U.S.
Okay, I have so many questions. Thank you for that incredibly comprehensive, CV, curriculum. So the first question I have for you is hearing about that first time. I want to go all the way back to when you were still between college and grad school. And mm-hmm. it was that you took such a risk to go overseas and spend a year somewhere that, you hadn't been before. So I want to know, when you got on that plane and you had that envelope with the address on, In that year, what happened for you? I suppose that probably was a formative year. From hearing you speak, you developed an attachment. You had always been fascinated, maybe enough to study Africa, but where did this attachment to the continent form? And then when did you really form your connection, as it were, to Zimbabwe?
Yeah, I think that's where my connection to Zimbabwe formed. Zimbabwe is a country that values education like none other I've seen. You have parents who, you know, sell their last cow to get their child to a better school. I still have this stark, maybe because it's a winter day today as you interview me in Zimbabwe, but I have a very, very stark, strong memory of teaching our classrooms. I was at a government, very, very rural school, and the classrooms, the windows were broken or didn't have glass. In my Form 1 class, we didn't have any furniture. So the kids were sitting on the ground on the concrete floor. Mm-hmm. A lot of them did not have jerseys. They were just sitting in their shorts and their little uniform shirts and shorts. Some of them didn't have shoes, and they're just shivering, but paying attention. And I'm teaching them the past tense, irregular verbs in English. Mm-hmm. And these little kids are just shivering and writing down their things, but they wanted, you know, nobody's complaining. There's like 55 of them. And then you're realizing these kids are supposed to be taking, at that point it was Cambridge O-level exams. I was teaching Macbeth in this rural area.
Wow.
And it was just, there was such a disconnect, not because these kids were not bright and could not take it, but I was thinking that the majority of them were not going to pass these exams. They were going to go back to the same area. And then the ones who did pass, really, maybe they're going to become a teacher or a nurse, because those are sort of the two rural occupations, mm-hmm. a policeman or something. But it really, really struck me that just the hunger for education, the desire for education here was so strong. And that's one thing. And the warmth that people, I was just brought into that community so warmly, that school community, and it really did give me an attachment to the country.
And I'm just thinking there, as you mentioned the curriculum, about the conversation I just had last week with Lawrence Alexander, and how that led to sort of, you know, many more conversations afterwards with other educators about how colonized the curriculum is and how much it still needs change. So yeah, that really is quite a shocking example of like, right, where is the relevance of this material to these students' lives, and how would they use it afterwards? And I'm sure that's something that we'll get to in terms of the curriculum you choose to embody in your own school. So then I wanted to just ask about Ed Matters. So Ed Matters is your nonprofit. And yes. Under the umbrella of that organization, you have lots of different initiatives going on. Tell us a little bit more about, before we get to the school and before we get to the story of the school opening this year, about some of the other projects that you're involved with.
Sure. So as I outlined with Ed Matters, we're trying to be a place where students can relate to opportunities. And one of the great things that happened with leaving the U.S. Embassy, like I said, no hard feelings, I had great, great work there, was being able to work with students going to different countries. So we have students in a lot of different countries. So we do not do one-on-one counseling. Somebody cannot pay our services. One of our tenets is that we have never charged a student for any service. We make our money through different methods. So for example, we might get a grant, like I said, for the Yale Young African Scholars, and then we are doing counseling for all the students who participated in that program. We run counselors training. So we've done a lot of college counseling training for people in schools here where there really is no such profession as a college counselor. There's an informal program we run called Pachipamwe. And Pachipamwe is a lovely Shona word, which means hello again, or I see you again. And it's a greeting you give people in the afternoon if you've seen them already in the morning.
I like that.
So we called our group Pachipamwe, as it's a soft landing program for students who decide to come home.
Right.
And it started with 8 students in a WhatsApp group. And it's not run by me. It's run by students who came home. Almost everyone who's worked ever and who works currently at Ed Matters is a Zimbabwean who went abroad and came back.
I saw
that. And that is true of our faculty and our school as well. So Pachipamwe now it's a really active group. I think it has around 80 young professionals. Mm-hmm. And it's everything from like, hey, I'm going to go to quiz night at this pub. Does anyone want to come? Yes, let's have a Pachipamwe group. Who wants to join the team? Great, let's go. It's things like that, as well as, does anyone know which is the best internet service provider? I just arrived in town. I don't know, you know, which one to take. So it's just helping people sort of have a place to share information who studied abroad and came back. So that's a part of our work as well.
Presumably the Patu Pamwe group is also a great place to get information about careers and about what career paths are available once you land back in the country.
It's interesting that we do a lot of informal headhunting. Like just this week, a bank, I won't mention which bank, a major bank in Zimbabwe, the head of their capital and investment banking called me and just said, hey, do you know who's coming home soon? Because we are looking for two analysts. And before I put it online, I would rather you send me CVs of people like, you know, you, Ed Matters. Do you know who? So we can put that in the Patu Pamwe group and say, hey, is anyone looking for a job? Here's a job. And we've, I think, probably informally have placed probably about 25 people in good jobs because locally people really value that you have two skins. You can work with a client in New York and you can work with somebody here in Harare and you know the culture of both workplaces. So there is that kind of work side, but I think there's also a lot of intense political discussions that go on Patu Pamwe.
Sounds a little bit like the UWC group. So I want to ask you then about the last piece of the puzzle then, the school that you just mentioned opening in January. So obviously a crazy year to open. I understand you have some students who couldn't make it out to go home. You mentioned that there are still some on campus and that your staff is having to rotate to be there as well. So tell us a little bit about how the year started and what that's been like, sort of trying to manage COVID in the middle of the opening of this new program, this new high school program.
Sure. So USAP Community School, we put out applications last year. We were pleased. We had about 650 applications for 45 spaces. And mostly pleased that people had the confidence in us because we did not have a building. We did not have land. We were brand new. And all we had to ride on was the reputation of USAP, which people know in Zimbabwe pretty well now after 20 years. And the first term was just all I can think of. The word I can think of to describe it was magical. It was just magical. 45 kids that we traveled around the country and interviewed the top 130. So we got from 650 to 130 through intense applications that are similar to like a Common App, essays and short answer questions, actually probably more intensive than a Common App. And we always, with USAP, it's always been our alumni who do the selection. So we had a whole range of USAP alum who came and read all the applications and they got it down to about 120, 130. And then a colleague, Collins, who's one of the founders of the school and myself, who's a USAP alum himself. We traveled the country and we did this in crazy 1600 kilometer 1 week trip where we interviewed the finalists in different towns and cities around the country.
How many finalists? You interviewed the 130?
120, 130, somewhere there. Wow. And then we gave them chemistry and math placement tests, an essay to write and an interview each place we went. And then we chose our 45. We have 25 girls and 20 boys. They come from rural areas, high density townships. We have three refugees from the refugee camp and they all came to school in January. The orientation we had on the first weekend was founded on our four values. Our school is built on values of equality, integrity, service, and curiosity. So we also have a very strong honor code and we had a ceremony the first weekend where everybody in the school community, the faculty, the staff, the students all signed the honor code. We have it prominently placed in our dining hall. And happily, no one has had any infractions of the honor code since we opened. So we started with the basis on values. We are a Quaker school. So if you know anything about the Society of Friends of the Quakers, their values are community and equality and justice, stewardship, integrity, etc. So similar values to ours. Yeah, and so school was humming along wonderfully and as a boarding school. And then all of a sudden, COVID. So the government here mandated all schools close on March 24th. Mm-hmm. We had about 3-4 days warning. So the teachers worked really hard. And granted, it was only a week and a half earlier than we were supposed to close for the April holidays. Okay. So we were kind of in closing mode, but we just like accelerated our schedule, gave all the kids end of term exams, and we work with Kindles. So we quickly loaded all of their textbooks onto all the Kindles and 2 months of work. And then we gave solar lights and solar chargers to about 12 of the kids who live really, really far from any electricity. And we sent everyone home. So from then, we've been doing school by WhatsApp. So April was, we had holiday work anyway. But when we got to May, we started with just WhatsApp office hours during April. And then starting in May, we actually have 3 classes a day. They're hour and a half classes. The teachers create small videos. We've figured out some software that makes them small enough. And they put the video, the 20-minute video, the night before so kids can download at night when the network's better. And then during the classes, they watch the videos. The teachers are there, use voice notes and text. And that's how we've been going along. It's not ideal, but at least we've been able to continue.
I'm just inspired by, you know, that sort of lo-fi approach. I mean, it still has technology embedded, but it would help so many other schools who've struggled with this, like, you know, access to internet and, you know, one computer per household, not per child, and things like that.
Yes.
So they watch a small video and then they're interacting in a synchronous way with the teacher through WhatsApp. Is that right?
Yeah, so we have WhatsApp groups for every class. Each student is on about 10 WhatsApp groups because they're on there 6 for classes.
Yeah.
And then we have them for extracurriculars. Like I run the media club, so we have our WhatsApp group and they're still doing media reports every week. They have the all school group. And then we have advising groups. So one feature of our school that's very strong is that we have a strong advisory system. Mm-hmm. Every teacher, faculty member has between 4 and 6 advisees and you meet every week. So that's where we've been continuing with counseling and sort of community building during all of this COVID.
Yeah.
And yeah.
How have your students, you know, found, I guess, yeah, being in part of a community that's far, are they all very far away from each other when they've moved back to their respective homes? And what about the students that were left on campus? How are they managing? How are your staff managing as well?
So on campus are our TAs, and those were some who couldn't go home. So we have 5, they are USAP students who are on their way to study overseas in August. And some of them didn't have somewhere to go. So they've stayed here. We have Wi-Fi here so they can continue. They were doing online classes through Pioneer Academics and preparing, you know, their placement tests and everything for university. So going home would mean no internet and not being able to do those things, as well as some of them just literally didn't have somewhere to go. But in general, our students are very, very far from each other. They are so missing school. Like they talk about it all the time in the WhatsApp groups. And the thing that's made me sort of heartened is that the culture has continued at the school. We have, you know, the jokesters are putting their jokes in the groups and people are still making fun of other people. We do something every morning at school, which is a roll call. And our headmaster, James, writes a letter to the kids every Friday. And he's continued that during the lockdown. And one of the letters was about the importance of roll call. It's not just because we want to make sure nobody's hiding out in their dorm. It's to sort of acknowledge that this community is, that every single person is vital to our community at school. Mm-hmm. So roll call every morning, the whole faculty staff are there. The students are there and they alphabetically go through the whole roll call. Somebody just goes through and everybody responds. So we've done now a roll call on WhatsApp. Once a week, where people respond with their favorite emoji, and it just goes through the whole school, whoops, through the whole school.
It's going to be hard to turn that back into what it originally was, I think.
But just trying to keep people to know that, like, I'm here, I see you, I hear you, I'm here with you, we're still a community, we're going to get through this, has been really important, I think. And that's why when we chose the name of the school, it was deliberately, the word community was there for a reason. That's a USAP community school. We really wanted to emphasize that we're intentionally building a community of equal learners. Part of our school that's really important, we have a work program. So faculty and students together do all the work. We only have 3 non-teaching staff, 2 cooks, because with everybody in class, you couldn't cook while you're in class. And 1 person who's like the driver, maintenance, builder type person. But otherwise, all of the work is done. The students and we're in work groups, and you take your advisory group might be on dishes. You're washing all the dishes. They might be cleaning the bathrooms. They might be raking the leaves. They might be recycling the garbage, doing the recycling. But all of the work, the classrooms cleaning, is done by students and teachers together.
And I bet that creates such strong bonds between them.
Yes. Yeah. They always talk about that. They say when we talk to our, when we talk to our friends, like that's come up too during, is their stories of when they tell their friends at home about our school and their friends just shake their heads. Like they talk about, yeah, I did dishes with the headmaster. Like, what? What do you mean you did dishes with the headmaster?
I know you'll be familiar with Corey's work, but you just reminded me of something he said about the community that he's running over at Imagine Scholar, where he said, you know, they send out, he's proudest when he sends his students to a college or to a program overseas, and he gets feedback about what good people they are. And, you know, that kind of activity is building exactly those traits in a person, that kind of humility, but also the ability to form part of a community and pitch in and be truly grateful, I guess, as well, for the time that they have with their professors, which must totally change the way they learn.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's also, I mean, when I think about the USAP students in general, one of the wonderful things about them going overseas in a cohort in kind of our global village now, they don't have to be in the same location, is that they do look out for each other. And I think in terms of mental health during university and all the stress of things, to have people you don't have to explain yourself to, you can and get on the phone and talk to, and they know exactly where you're from. We have a buddy system with USAP when they go overseas for the, that we started with the Ed Matters groups, where they each have, we they each have two buddies, and we assign them, knowingly that they don't assign them their friends, but like two other people in the cohort, and they must touch base with their two buddies every week, but no one falls through a crack. And then if they're worried about any of their buddies, they can get in touch and say, hey, I've been trying to talk to so-and-so and I'm concerned about him. And I think that that same spirit I see at the school, that there's so much care for each other. There's just so much care. If somebody is upset about something, immediately the whole school is upset about it too.
That's amazing, because, you know, there's work and research that's been done on place and on, you know, international students, but particularly international students of color feeling out of place when they get to US college campuses. And, you know, there's this whole, where do I stand and what group do I belong to thing. And I think, I mean, I really respect that you're trying to build, or that you have built this amazing group that look out for each other. And you as a school are still invested in the students that you've known for years, long after they are graduates. So that must help so much in terms of that acclimatization and that assimilation to a new culture as well. And that's probably what makes them so employable. And as you've said, you know, makes them so desirable when they do come home to those employers. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you've talked about values of community and Quaker values. I wonder if you could go more into the values that you also live and that you've wanted to embody in terms of your own work, but also to give on, to pass on to your students and to make sure they carry out into the world.
We're trying, another reason that I really wanted to have more time with our students, and which led to the school and having 2 years with the student rather than time during their vacations, is that I really wanted them to think about the impact they want to make, the legacy they want to leave, because I think it's so easy to get lost when students leave home and get to a place where all the pressure is on your career and money and your next steps, and nobody is telling you, like, how does this affect your grandmother who lives in the village? Like, nobody is helping you think that through. And then I've had too many broken kids who, after not necessarily USAP kids, but because I also worked at the embassy with all students, Zimbabweans who would go off to Wall Street and be very successful and then come home when they're like 28 and, you know, on a 2-week visit and just say, I don't know what I'm doing with my life. Like, what am I doing? What's the point? You know, what am I?
Yeah.
And this is like a really bright kid, but the way that career advising happens at a lot of universities, it's not set up for a low-income international student to think about all those things. Nobody's walking them through those processes. So the values of knowing where you come from and not having it limit you, but have it inspire you to figure out what you want to do, I think that's something that's important to me. The finding value in every person you meet, that sort of like seeing the light in each person you meet and trying to, yeah, acknowledge them equally with that value. That's something that's really important to me. And just feeling like I wanting students to know that there's nothing you can't talk about right now. I think in stark contrast, you know, our schools here are very formal and they're very exam driven in Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. They're very O levels and A levels and people want to take more and more. They want to have, you know, 15 O levels instead of 10, and they want to have 5 A levels instead of, you know, and they're just racking up all these exams. And then the relevance of education to their lives is not that apparent. So valuing communication about what's important. So I guess better in an example. So when all the Black Lives Matter movement and the response to the George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and everything is going on the last few weeks, mm-hmm. I just took time in my class. I teach research methodologies. That's the class I teach. And I took time, I guess, a week ago Friday and said, today we're going to discuss systemic racism. What is it? Here's a video to watch. That's the video they watched. And you're coming from a place where you're looking at this very different. You're coming from an African community where your heritage is valued, but you're going into a world where this exists. So let's mm-hmm. talk about it. I don't think many schools here would do that. So I think valuing that there's nothing we can't talk about, let's discuss, that's the purpose of education. That's why curiosity became one of the values of the school. The first day in my class, I asked them, what are you curious about? And then because we're doing research methodologies, they now know that they have to be careful how they answer questions. Because I said, great, now you're going to go find out the answers to that question of what you're curious about. That's what you're going to do. That's your homework. So I think the values we chose for the school were very carefully chosen. Equality, integrity, service, and curiosity. Yeah.
I find it amazing that the national system is not preparing students for what they may encounter in terms of that systemic racism or those approaches to... At first, when you explained that you were covering that in class, I thought that you might be teaching what actually exists within the country as well, that you might be talking about systemic inequalities within Zimbabwe too, to get them to sort of switch it on its head and see it from their own country's perspective too. But I am quite amazed that that's and I guess, you know, you have Britain to thank for that. The colonial curriculum has not extended that far, and it's just another reason why we can see that some curricular pieces are just not fit for purpose any longer. I have a couple of questions about the changes in your own career and how you work now versus at the start of your career. How did you kind of get to the point that you're at now? Because I think a lot of teachers might listen and say, yes, I've always had a dream to start a school too, but actually doing it is a vast journey.
Well, the practicalities, I raised 5 girls, or I am raising, I have my last one at home. And so when they were little, yeah, there's a limitation. And I'd say that just because I think people become harsh on themselves. But when you've got children running around and you have to figure out how you're feeding 7 mouths that night, the extra energy you have to do more things is limited. But so part of that is just, you know, that natural course. But I think what's crystallized to me is are issues that I feel I can be a voice for, and then not wanting to be a voice for issues where other people should be that voice. And I think that's very important even in the current debates we're having. I don't want to be a voice for things that it's not my place to be a voice for. But I do feel like we need to have more debate about access and not lip service. If a university, for example, is going to take, say, we really want a student, this amazing kid who comes from a rural part of an African country, we really want their voice on our campus. We really see their value here. And then they say, by the way, you need to pay for the DHL cost to get your I-20 form sent, and we need this cost charge and we need that charge. There's a lot of times where the practicalities and the systems that are in place are not in line with what access really means. What does inclusion really mean in international education? So that's something that I feel really strongly about, and I feel like I can be an advocate for. I also feel like we just are sounding like a broken record with our educational system sometimes. And so that's my hope with this school, is that I know that funders and people, all that businesses and prizes out there and contests are all about scalability. How scalable is your model? Are you going to have 500 schools on the continent of Africa by 2030 and have thousands of kids? And my answer is no. We're going to have one fantastic intentional school that we would love people to come and learn from and be a model internationally of what a transformative education looks like for a high-achieving, low-income student, and how you build this community of trust in education, and how do you build a school based on values. and how we haven't talked about the curriculum, but what are the skills that you're teaching a student so that when they hit university, they are ready to hit the ground running and do really transformative, fantastic things. So I think it's crystallized to me that there needs to be more thought into the work that's happening now. And I feel like at some point you just have to jump off the cliff. And that's what I did when I left the embassy. I just really said, you know what? I don't want to spend another 15 years doing what I've done for the last 15 years. It's been fantastic, but I'm ready. Mm-hmm. And when you're ready, you just have to jump off that cliff. And I know it's a huge privilege. I understand that privilege to be able to do that, to be in a situation where you have a roof over your head and you can take a pay cut and just, and not everyone can do that. But it's sometimes, yeah, you make those hard choices.
Oh, and I think, you know, you have to be applauded for that because it's difficult. And I'm sure it wasn't an easy ride for you. And before you tell us about maybe some of the challenges you've had in setting up all of this, let's go to that. Let's go to the curriculum. You told me that you teach research methods, which obviously is not a usual high school class. So what else is different about your curriculum?
So our curriculum, we do have three A-levels. Our students are taking sciences. So they either do math physics chem or math bio chem. We had to start with something. And because their English was coming in at all different levels, we decided best we start with base of math and science. So they do have three A-level classes, Cambridge A-levels. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting to me is the other half of the curriculum. And we do have ways that we teach, which is different. One thing that we do in our class that we took actually from visiting a Barso school in Somaliland is that every class starts with what's called a do now. So the teacher, when the students walk in, the teachers have something on the board and it's an exercise. It's a free write or it's a math problem, but it's do now. So you walk in and the minute you hit your class, the minute the class starts, you're working on something. Then the teacher can be doing all the stuff they have to do to sort of get ready. And you go straight into the topic. So there's none of this sort of like easing yourself into class. But our curriculum is based on the three A-levels and then a humanities core, which is asking big questions and using literature and current affairs and such to answer those questions. So that we're looking at power and equality through Animal Farm. So we have humanities core. Then we have research methodologies, which I teach, which is a capstone project. So the first year it's teaching research methodologies. So far we've done oral histories, we've done interviews, we've done surveys, we've done online research, academic, scientific method, but different research methodologies and very applied. That's been very wonderful with COVID because we have done service learning projects at home, oral histories where they interviewed extensively over about 10 hours elderly people in their community. Right now they're doing survey. We did a class survey of 600 respondents on attitudes towards where people get their information on COVID. So we've been able to make it very applied. And the second year of that class, they will write a capstone project and they will be researching a problem in their community or in the country, researching the causes and figuring out how possible solution to that. And they will have an academic mentor on the faculty here, as well as somebody in the field who is a USAP alum who will be a mentor.
It's college level work already. As you said, they leave you very ready to engage in
Then they also have a critical thinking reasoning class and finally a computer literacy class. So we hope that when they're through here, yes, they know how to write a research paper. They've known how to, they've done a lot of critical thinking. They've done a lot of just sort of more trying to figure out place and purpose for themselves through their academics than just doing exams.
So tell me a little bit about your students then. What do they do for fun? Who are they?
We do have fun. So it's an intense schedule at our school. They wake up when I have morning prep. Once a week I have morning prep. Morning prep is at 6. So they wake up pretty early. By 6 in the morning prep, breakfast at 7, they start classes. Mm-hmm. And classes, lunch, more classes. We finish classes around 2:30. And then 3 to 5 are activities. And we tried to introduce activities that, one, we could do without. We don't have large sports facilities and such. So activities we could do, but we want the activities to be things that they do to excellence, not just sort of like, oh, I go and sit in a club meeting and then I go away. So they're getting really into them and that's where they have a lot of fun. We do archery, we have chess, we have debate, we have the media club, we have an a cappella group that's fantastic, cross-country team, and of course, football, soccer.
Oh, yes. I saw you're an Arsenal fan. I was going to ask you about that.
I'm wearing my jersey right now because we have our game tonight. First COVID game tonight. Big Arsenal fan. So they, yeah, so they do have fun. And we, even for example, with football like that, we have some kids who are really into football. So we do match of the week and we show one match on the weekend. But they're just like teenagers. I mean, they like to laugh. They like to fool around. They want to make videos of themselves dancing, or, you know, they have their regular teenage stuff, but they do have an intense schedule. After dinner, we have prep from mandatory prep till 9 and optional till 10:30. And every night about, I would say 80% of them stay till 10:30, go to their rooms, go to sleep, wake up at 5, start the whole thing again. We have a 6-day calendar. So we do labs on Saturdays. Labs. We don't have labs at our school, so we're very thankful to a school in Harare called Hellenic, where we go on Saturday mornings to use their labs. So Sunday is really the day off, and we have a Quaker meeting. We hike to this beautiful rock that overlooks the valley, and we sit in silence for an hour. And some people choose to sing or speak, but we have a Quaker meeting there, and then the rest of the day on Sunday they have off.
I'm getting the sense that they are very, very determined individuals who make it through not just your selection process, but actually who, you know, make it through a term, make it through a year, make it through the whole cycle.
I'm trying to think, I haven't told a lot of stories, but one story that's really fresh in my mind, because it just happened a few weeks ago, that shows that determination. A student by the name of Trimore, and I only tell you his name because it fits the story. He's staying with his grandmother in a rural area, and he was quite far from electricity. So when we moved to having the classes on schedule on WhatsApp, he wasn't able to join, because what he would do is walk a few kilometers to a store that had electricity, and then he would plug in his phone and his Kindle and charge them, and then he would go back at the end of the day and get them charged, and then he would do all his work at night. So that was not working out for him. He's missing the classes. So he told me, I said, what are we going to do? And he said, no, I've talked to my uncle. He works in a lumber factory about 35 kilometers away. So I'm going to go and stay with him, because he said I could stay in the room with him that he has at the staff quarters and they have electricity. So I said, great. And then only to find out on the weekend, I was like, so Trimore, are you set? And he said, no, I'm on my way. And I didn't understand. He walked 35 kilometers to go and find his electricity for class.
Oh my goodness.
He started Sunday morning and got there Monday morning. Wow. Just walked all day and all night.
Yeah.
Incredibly determined.
I mean, I guess, you know, their college application essays write themselves in so many ways, but I'm torn as a former college counselor, as a careers advisor, right? I'm torn between understanding what colleges will see in these students and how valuable they are in any college campus that they leave you to be on and what they'll bring with them. Mm. I'm also reminded of some of the other guests I've had on that have talked about just wanting their students to go out into the world and be good. And, you know, what are we placing energy towards as a society? And, you know, what is the reason? What's the why for all of this being done? And I wonder if you wouldn't mind commenting a little bit on that, on, you know, how success is measured, not just within your school community, but also for you, when you see these students leave you, what makes you proudest?
Yeah, I think what makes me proudest is some of them, just their deciding to channel their energies into making a difference. And yeah, to back up Corey, that they're good people. I mean, it's amazing. Right now we are doing major fundraising because we're trying to build a school, which is not, you know, a cheap endeavor. Mm-hmm. And our entire fundraising committee, all the volunteers, they're alumni from this program. And they're out there. And some of them are very successful people now. And they're giving themselves and they are putting in the time. One woman in particular, Rue, she probably gives us about 20 hours of her week while she is a vice president of a bank, because she is so determined that we are going to build a school. Like, other people need the same opportunity I had, and we're going to help them get it. So that really inspires me. We have students who are working on HIV and COVID vaccines. We have, you know, alumni. We have alumni who are on the front lines of the disease right now as doctors and nurses. So it's just a lot of them, whether they decide to physically come back, which we're hoping more and more of them will, to rebuild this country, whether they're somewhere else in Africa, whether they are still schooling overseas or they've stayed overseas, so many of them are just actively making a difference. on global issues or on local issues. And I think that makes me proud.
So connected to that, who inspires you in your work? And I guess a lot of that is going to be your students. Who else out there in the world?
No, and fellow educators, I definitely would put a shout out to the Holly Access Network. In 2016, together with an admissions officer called Rebecca Westfall, we started the Holly Access Network. And that is a network of organizations, Imagine Scholar being one of them that you have on the program. We are now 38 organizations around the continent who are all doing this work of college access work. And when we do get to get together, we didn't this year because of COVID, but it's so inspiring because these are people, many of them from their home communities, from the continent, who are just, again, putting their life into trying to help other students and other young people get opportunities that some of them didn't have themselves. So they are very inspiring to me.
So HALI stands for High Achieving Low Income. And yeah. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the work there, because I think that's a shout out worth giving some more signposting to for listeners who want to find out more.
Sure. So what we realized with Rebecca Westfall was we were able to get a small grant in 2016 to bring together at the time about 20 people who I had heard about all these people, but we never get to meet because maybe three of us get the grant to go to the conference in the US and then the rest of them are on the continent. So I'd heard of Bridge to Rwanda and I'd heard of Gashora Girls School and heard of all these people, but had not met. And so everybody came to Zimbabwe and I just got a lodge and we went and basically told stories to each other and shared best practices and spent a few days together and then decided, you know what? We should become more of a lobbying force. Let's have our own association and not go to international education conferences where you are one or two people from Africa. So we did that and became the Holly Access Network. And I head up the advocacy committee of it now. And we've done things like gotten free SATs for our students from the College Board. We've done things like write letters against the immigration ban when that happened and get them published. But we are mostly sharing resources. What I like is it's a very collaborative group. So there's none of this, oh, I heard about a scholarship, let me keep it for my students. It's like, no, I heard about a scholarship, guys, here it is, and shared with the whole network. So we share a lot of resources. I think my Holly Access WhatsApp group has got at least two or three messages every day on it. People asking, hey, does anybody know which credential evaluator can waive the fee for such and such? Sure, here it is. That was the message today, actually. But just a lot of information sharing and trying to realize that together we're stronger as a sort of lobbying force in international education than we are as individuals.
Yes. And I think I heard about HALI through the work I did it as a counselor, because there was always lobbying being done by other counselors I knew who had were part of it, Ed Tool being one of them, for resources. You know, if we're going to pool resources, then let's do it in a way. And as you know, I think I'm very much a sort of open source minded person who always wanted to try and pool counseling resources and information that was up to date. And I remember coming into contact with what HALI did and being amazed, and also having seen some of the representatives at the Council of International Schools Conference, which is where I saw your incredible keynote, your amazing talk. So I'm really impressed with what HALI do. And is there any plan to grow bigger? There's that question again for you.
What we want to do is maintain our criteria. So the size can be dictated by that. And our criteria is that a HALI member, or it's not a person who's a member, it's an organization or in some cases a school, but a HALI member works with high achieving, low income students on the continent of Africa, and they're working on international admissions. So, you could have like thousands of schools and in African countries that have high achieving, low income students, but the next part of it is that they are actively working on helping open up international educational opportunities for tertiary education for those students. And so, yes, we have expanded every year, but we expand slowly. We get, membership applications and we review them. We have a membership committee and we might have four or five new members a year. What's tough is that we do have the HALI Indaba every year, which is where we all get together. And so far, we've been so lucky to get funding to be able to bring one representative from every organization every year to that. And it changes countries. So we've done it in Ghana and Rwanda and Kenya and Zimbabwe. And we were supposed to have one in Nairobi in May. Mm-hmm. So as we expand and get larger, it's going to be more and more difficult to be able to fund that opportunity for everyone. So those are some of the things we've been thinking through, is what other ways we can work together.
So how can anybody who's listening who thinks, you know, I'd like to support or help in some way, how can they get involved?
Yeah. So with Holly, we do have friends of Holly, and we have some educators, some admissions people, like organizations who join us, and they are part of our conversations and such, who are working on access and inclusion and international education. So I would just encourage them. There's a lot of contact details on the Holly website, which is hollyaccess.org. And for the USAP Community School, as I mentioned, we are in the midst of huge fundraising. Our goal is that our own alumni will eventually fund the operations of the school, but that we still need to build buildings and such. And if you go to usapschool.org, you'll see that there's a place there where you can support us.
That's fantastic. I'm really, really grateful for the time you've given to the podcast. I know how busy you must be. Your life must be just a whirlwind of board meetings and of committees as well as teaching. So I thank you for your time, and I wish you a great sort of successful coming together of your cohort again when you can all meet in person.
No, thank you so much. And I guess I just would end by saying that when you meet that student who needs that much more time or that extra funding or that extra care, look deeper, because you'll be surprised at what an impact that one student might be able to make.
Yeah, that's a really awesome place to finish. In fact, I had wanted to ask you, what would you say to the next guests in series two if they happen to be college admissions folk, and you've just said it then. That's the message that they need.
Speaking to Rebecca was an inspiring experience in so many ways. She understands that she cannot be a voice for the whole continent, nor even for the experience of her Zimbabwean students when they are abroad. But as with any great champion or ally, she is utterly intentional about how and where she uses her influence. She is a powerful advocate for access and inclusion in her own community in Zimbabwe, her community in the USA, and across international higher education. The Holly Network's goals are to share ideas, resources, and experiences to improve their work with high-achieving low-income students, to provide relevant, insightful information to the wider college admissions community, and to advocate on issues affecting their students to be able to increase scholarship opportunities and support. If you're listening and you work for a university that strives for diversity and inclusion, there is a clear call to action here. If you're not already seeking out opportunities to work alongside organizations like Holly and like USAP and so many others that exist out there, then now's the time. To any other educator who has been profoundly moved, as I am, by what Rebecca and her team of alumni, supporters, and friends do, then you can also support her work directly. Visit edmattersafrica.org, hollyaccess.org, and donations for the USAP Community School are gratefully received at usapschool.org/donate. Thanks for tuning in. See you next time. You can stay up to date on Piloted by following us on Instagram and Facebook at The Piloted Podcast, or you can say hi on Twitter, just at The Piloted. Thanks for tuning in.